I'm Bill Buebert, retired Army officer and irregular warfare practitioner and scholar. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts, an irregular warfare podcast, the show that examines the mythos, lost history, bad thinking, martial malpractice, and government incompetence that informs so much of irregular warfare. I want to peek behind the curtain at the vast machinery and briar patch politics of insurgency and counterinsurgency, and everything in between. Now, let's go ghost hunting together. Hi, this is Bill, and welcome to episode 46 of Chasing Ghosts and Irregular Warfare podcast. Title of this podcast today will be Review and Discussion, My Lai, Vietnam, 1968, and The Descent into Darkness by Howard Jones. As usual, some slight housekeeping is in order. I'll be really busy over the next few weeks to include getting ready for my presentations and tutorials that I give at the professional organization, the national professional organizations that I'm a member of, and that will be out in Calizuela, no less. But I'm looking forward to the trip. So I've been rather busy with my day job, with preparation for that conference, reading books like the one I and the number of books I did to prepare myself for this particular episode. And I wanted to reflect very quickly on the last two episodes I did, where I talked about concepts of operations, work breakdown structures, product breakdown structures, pretty much how the systems of systems and systemic thinking is done in operations research and operations analysis. I've gotten emails and communications from listeners since I started this nearly 2 years ago on what is the basis for which I would investigate something? What is the basis upon which I gather evidence? What are the distinctions between forecasting and prediction? What are the frameworks that I use from a critical thinking perspective to investigate and interrogate these various things that I take on in this podcast series? Hence, I had a twofold reason for doing the last two episodes, and if you avoided them, there it is. But number one was to show you what is the basis, the framework, and the visionary formulation that I employ in order to interrogate things critically and come to conclusions in, my favorite phrase when it comes to this, reaching the single most accurate picture of what something is, how they got there, and what that may portend for the future. And then the second thing I'd like to observe is this, is that if you take on the things that I discussed in the last two episodes, you take it on your personal life or your professional life. Let's talk about your professional life very briefly. If you take those things on seriously and you establish baselines and through consensus or persuasion, wherever you may work, you make sure that not only are these baselines rational, but you've crafted an intent that everybody agrees to. It's within the rational resources and capabilities of the organization you happen to work for. And I guarantee you the return on investment of doing this at the beginning instead of the middle or the end will save you thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars in whatever business enterprise you are engaged in. I guarantee it. If you want further, rather exhaustive conversation about that, get in touch with me via email. Maybe we can chat about it sometime. But I guarantee you, if you take those to heart and you use them and you become that contrarian, that 10th man, that red teamer, that person who has the moral courage to look at what's going on around you, wherever you may work, and of course I've observed you can also apply this in your personal life, you'll be better for it. And as is customary, if you wish to get in touch with me, you can either go to my Substack, which will be in the show notes, along with some book recommendations I have here, to include a very long moral injury list, because I think moral injury is such a huge thing right now, and I'm so proud to say, as I did in a previous episode when I had just gone to Special Operations Forces Week, that the Joint Special Operations University and SOCOM have employed and paid the salaries of four folks that were up on the lectern talking about moral injury, taking it seriously, and even developing skills and tool chests for soldiers or civilians who think or perceive they may have suffered from moral injury, and gives them a way to work with that. Try to put it in the proper frame. From my Stoic perspective, I know that the moral injury that I have suffered, and by the way, I suffered it, but I put myself in that position. No one else is to blame. I put myself there to get the moral injury. I will live with that the rest of my life, but I just find ways to take the edge off when it comes to that. And Stoicism is what informs my best coping mechanisms. And by the way, you need those coping mechanisms when you're dealing with a snapshot, a picture in freeze frame, a journey into quite literally the heart of darkness. The Descent into Darkness, as Howard Jones subtitles his book, My Lai, Vietnam, 1968, and The Descent into Darkness. This is a crushing book. This book is not for the faint of heart. This book is not for those who find themselves sensitive to seeing just how depraved and low and toxic singular human beings could be, but more so singular human beings in the military-industrial complex, and in this case, in that snapshot of 1968, that kind of gross violation of human decency standards from beginning to end that told us what happened here in this massacre of nearly 500 Vietnamese men, women, and children, a lot of older men, a lot of younger women, a lot of pregnant women, a lot of babies, lots of children under six. It's searing. So if you are squeamish or faint of heart and you're just not in the mood to have me darken your day for the next hour, because I guarantee you, whatever you do the next hour, if you listen to this podcast, I am going to take you to a place you may not want to be, and this is going to live inside you for the rest of your life if you're a decent and reflective human being. So with that cautionary note, we will move ahead. Way back in episode 38, which was entitled Moral Injury, The Invisible Warrior Marks, which was something I had been wanting to do for a long time, and I'm so glad that moral injury as a concept is gaining legs. And what moral injury is what is the damage that warfare does to the mindset and the peace of mind and the entire emotional framework of soldiers and those who not only directly deal in the death-making, but also tangentially may be there to witness said death-making and how that sears your soul. I've hinted in the past at how I think, especially when I was talking about French Indochina and French Algeria and the employment by the French as a means of exacting answers to questions and the use of torture, I said, and I'm paraphrasing here, and I can't recall who said it, but if somebody comes up with a good reprise on who said it so that I can give them credit, please let me know. But whatever a torturer does, the corruption that they visit upon the soul of those that they torture touches them themselves. It can't be helped. I mean, this is such a torture and the infliction of pain on another human being in that fashion is frankly evil. And for the most part, from my reading of the literature, it really does nothing to fill in the information gaps one may have on the battlefield at the tactical, operational, and strategic level, and there's really no reason to do it. Yet, we had these manifestations, for instance, in the latest Iraq war starting in 2003, where in the Bush administration, we had an entire legal apparatus that bent over backwards out of the OLC to describe a rendition program, a torture program. None of this is new. I talked about this recently in one of my dispatch essays where I talked about what happened in 1898 through the beginning of the 20th century when America was on its colonial enterprises planet-wide after it had eradicated the aboriginal hordes in North America proper, at least to the standards of eradication that Americans would seek. and what was happening in the Philippines. I would urge you, if you get a chance, to read Dispatch number 7, where I talked about why Memorial Day, for a variety of reasons, is a fraud. And again, if you wish not to go down that dark path, don't read the essay. But Milay has so many interesting things to say about it. It's awful. For those of you not familiar, it was a massacre in what was referred to as Pinkville, because Milay wasn't only one place. It was Milay 1, 2, and a number of others in this operation that was conducted by this company that was there under Captain Medina, under whom Lieutenant Cali was leading one of his platoons. That was March 15th, 1968. Medina gathers his troops around to let them know what they're in for and going into Pinkville. They're assuming that there's going to be a tremendous amount of Viet Cong, possibly North Vietnamese soldier organizational strength, weapons, caches, tunnels, you name it, and he was pumping them up. And what it turns out he did, in Nick Turse's terms, in his book, Kill Anything That Moves, is they went in there and they slaughtered men, women, and children that day. Now, you will have to read, I don't recommend you do so because I haven't read all 32 volumes of the Piers Commission report that occurred to investigate everything that happened, because the Army, by the way, almost put this under the rug. They almost got away with this. They almost institutionally, bureaucratically, and I would say immorally, did an end run around the law of warfare violations, the war crimes violations. They almost got away with it, except for some very heroic human beings, to include a certain warrant officer by the name of Thompson. I think he was a W-2 aviator at the time, who went on to retire as a major, I think. And Thompson was the one who came back because of what he saw from his helicopter. As a matter of fact, not only did he see some of the slaughter of men, women, and children, he actually landed his bird and instructed his crew that if they had to open fire on the soldiers who were between him and the Vietnamese people, unarmed, who he was trying to protect, which, of course, that really drew the attention in the after-action review, where the battalion, brigade, and division commanders were, they took great affront that an American soldier would even speculate about opening fire on other American soldiers to protect indigenous human beings who everyone appeared to be fighting. Milay has sort of, there's a cottage industry out there. And I remember reading a couple essays. I read the Army Historical Association assessment, and I was vaguely aware of the Piers Commission 32-volume report. And like I confessed, I haven't read all 32 volumes, but I have seen summaries, précis, and abstracts of what went on. And what's really interesting about all of this is that it takes place in 1968. It takes place in March of 1968, March 16th to be precise. Now, those of you familiar with the Vietnam War history, that really small splinter of American involvement from 54 till 1975. I say 54, and I know that most American troops landed on the ground in 62, 63, 65, but you have to understand that a lot of the preparation of getting soldiers there started to occur after the defeat of the French at Dien Bien Phu in 1954, and I speak about that in one of my earlier episodes where I talk about the French in Indochina. This Tet Offensive started in January. Phase 1 was January to March. Phase 2 was May to June, and Phase 3 was August to September. And what it was a major escalation in one of the largest military campaigns of the Vietnam War in the South. The VC, Viet Cong, and the North Vietnamese People's Army of Vietnam, the PAVN, launched a surprise attack on January 30th, 1968, against the forces of the South Vietnamese Army of the Republic of Vietnam, hereby referred to as ARVN. Now, campaign of surprise attacks against military and civilian command and control centers throughout South Vietnam, contemporaneously, simultaneously. The name is the truncated version of the Lunar New Year festival name in Vietnam, Vietnamese, which is Tet Nguyen Dan, with the offense chosen during a holiday period as most ARVN personnel were on leave. The purpose of the wide-scale offensive by the Hanoi Politburo was to trigger political instability in a belief that massed armed assault on urban centers would trigger defections and rebellions. Well, by the way, it did not do that. It was a very bloody affair. Many would say that since the Tet Offensive was defeated at the tactical level, it was a win for South Vietnam. I suggest to you that it may have been a win for South Vietnam, but it was a strategic victory for the North Vietnamese because 1968 was a banner year. As I've just noted, My Lai took place in March of 1968. Now, mind you, let's hop in that time travel machine, and you're a grunt on the ground in South Vietnam, and you're going to go to this place called Pinkville, which we all know today as My Lai, and these different hamlets and villages that are there, and you're doing this under the rubric and umbrella of what's been occurring in the Tet Offensive for 2.5 months, and it has been brutal, it has been bloody, and the number of ARVN killed and the number of U.S. and Allied soldiers killed has been tremendous. Maybe that number started approaching some of the largest losses for the U.S. and Allies in the entire conflict itself. If you get a chance to read Mark Bowden's book on Tet, I highly recommend it. I will make sure I put that in the show notes. It's just as Mark Bowden is very thorough, it's just a very thorough overview of what happened that entire time, the implications before, and the implications post-September when the Tet Offensive ended and what it did. In my mind, looking back with the legacy of hindsight, and I find that a lot of things are coupled together like this, My Lai, and we're going to talk about that a little more in this episode, of course, and the Tet Offensive happening in the same year, I think what this did is it rocketed from the starting blocks the eventual defeat, well, let's say eventual stalemate, defeat, and withdrawal from Vietnam of the U.S. and its allies. And I would suggest that if these things hadn't happened in the same year, if the Tet Offensive had not happened, and if My Lai hadn't happened, that we may have been stuck in Vietnam for far longer than 1975, 1972 and 1973 being when most U.S. combat forces have or were in the process of withdrawing in the last 2 years was just the diminishment, encirclement, and destruction of what was left of South Vietnam. We need a timeline here for you guys to keep in mind, and that would be this. So on March 16th, you have the assault on Pinkville, in which My Lai and a couple of other places were, in which these massacres took place that took the lives of nearly 500 men, women, and children, unarmed, who were there. What's curious, too, is that when you look at the after-action reports, they say that initially they had killed 120 to 180 VC, but they only retrieved 3 weapons. Doesn't make much sense from a military perspective. When journalists actually did their jobs, unlike today, none of us would know anything about this, and all of this would have been covered up if not for some folks who were very brave and some folks like Rob Ridenour and Seymour Hersh who broke this story wide open and forced the hand of the army to hold these officers and men accountable. Because it just so happens that initially that the war crimes investigation was initiated by General Coster at the division level, and his battalion and brigade commanders balked at that. And it just so happens that one Major Colin Powell at the time conducted the 15-6 investigation, which is Army lingo for a formal investigation into a complaint. Now, mind you, they did not do this via the IG's office. They did not retain the proper paper documentation of having done that. They didn't do the vertical and horizontal heavy lifting that they should have done in order to determine just what happened that day and whether it rose to the level of war crimes. And Major Colin Powell brings his findings back to the division commander, Coster, in this case, General Coster, and says, nope, can't find any evidence of that. I'm not surprised by that, and I'm not blaming Colin Powell necessarily for that, because he's doing institutionally what officers tended to do in the big green machine and tend to do today, which is don't rock the boat, don't be a 10th man, don't be a contrarian, and you got to get on because your promotion opportunities mean that you're going to play the game. In this case, the game turned out to be a cover-up, because between March 16th, when this slaughter occurred, and March 29th, 1969, remember, My Lai occurred in 1968, March 16th, March 29th, 1969, Rob Ridenour, he writes a letter describing the My Lai incident and its cover-up after a chance and opportune meeting with one of the soldiers who had been there. April 23rd, 1969, the Inspector General makes a full inquiry, and by the way, there was some rug shuffling going on here also. June 13th, 1969, Hugh Thompson, that warrant officer that I told you about with the helicopter, identified William Calley as the officer present at My Lai. On August 4th, 1969, General Westmoreland orders the IG to turn over the investigation to the Criminal Investigation Division. And then September 4th, 1969, charges are brought against Lieutenant Calley, who just so happened to be at Fort Benning at the time and had just returned from a civil affairs detail in Vietnam. I get the sense from all of my reading that Calley was a very middling and insecure combat arms officer, in this case, an infantry officer in the U.S. Army, who happened to have done everything he could to impress his company commander at the time, Captain Medina, who was also instrumental in giving the impression, and it's, but one, if you were to review all the stuff in those 32 volumes of the Pierce Commission, you would probably be able to divine that Medina may have hemmed and hawed, but he left the door wide open for the slaughter of men, women, and children in Pinkville, My Lai, because of the ambiguity, and I happen to think that his ambiguity was intentional, of not telling them directly, if someone doesn't have a weapon, do not fire upon them. Now, by the way, My Lai, when you read all of the anecdotal accounts, even when you read unit accounts and things like that, if a young male is running away from a village that is subject to a jump incursion by hellebore forces in Vietnam from the time we were there until the time we left, for the most part, it was a fire-free zone where they would be shot up if they were fleeing, even if they weren't carrying a weapon, if they happened to be identified as a military-age male. Timelines are important here. Now, it just so happens that November 3rd, and this is going to be approximately 3 months after General Westmoreland orders the IG investigation, Nixon announces a Vietnamization program. And this Vietnamization program is something that should have happened from the get-go, which was a foreign internal defense program to use special forces and special operations forces, ARGO, to actually get the South Vietnamese on a level footing with the North Vietnamese to defend themselves and have a competent army. Wow, voila, look what happened in Afghanistan. Didn't work out there either. No one's learned any lessons as far as that's concerned. But nonetheless, the intention and the ambition was there for making it so that eventually the U.S. could pull out. November 13th, 10 days after that, the first story of My Lai is published in the Cleveland Plains Dealer. A second story is published the next day with eyewitness accounts. And the photos from a combat cameraman who happened to be there with both Army cameras in black and white and his personal camera in color just so happened to be available, and those photos were released, which provided tremendous corroboration to what had been on a low boil on the back burner for the longest time, because, of course, pictures speak 1,000 words. December 13th, the Secretary of Defense reports that anyone involved in the killings will be prosecuted, and then the company commander there at the time, under whom Callie was a platoon leader, Captain Ernest Medina, is charged with murder on March 10th, 1970. Mind you, this is nearly 2 years after what happened in My Lai, and I hate to say this, but the Army was doing this because they'd been caught. Otherwise, they would have buried it. March 14th, just 4 days later, the Pierce Report is delivered to Westmoreland, that 32 volumes that I talked about, incredibly thorough. And Howard Jones, the author of the book that I showcase in this review and discussion, he relied a lot on that, not to mention other data. When you look at the footnotes and citations in Jones' book, it's absolutely exhaustive. This is one of those historical enterprises where there is so much data available, surprisingly enough. So many, you know, if you learn how to use the National Archives and you know how to use and exploit primary and secondary source documentation, the gold mines are there for any number of things that one would wish to investigate. I happen to think that Howard Jones' book is probably the most thoroughgoing, not to mention dark, not to mention bleak, but probably one of the most comprehensive examinations of this for a popular audience, even those who may not have been in the military. It almost reads as a crime novel, but then again, it is not a crime novel, but crime does, well, it is necessarily, it isn't, because this is crime nonfiction. I can't recommend this book enough. I love hardcover books, so I got this in hardcover. I've also listened to it on Audible. I've read the book, and then I've listened to it on Audible, and it's just it's a gut-wrenching experience. I think it's a necessary experience. If any of my audience members have the least inkling that you may have suffered or you may be adjacent to moral injury, this book will provide you something of a catharsis. It will provide you something of a means to deal with some of the darker reservations that may have been buried in your unconscious after coming from a war zone, and to help you deal with it better. I can't recommend this book enough. It's just it's a searing indictment. Now, 14 officers were charged with offenses related to My Lai. Charges against the officers not at My Lai were dropped. Of course, this includes the battalion commander, the brigade commander, and the division commander. Isn't that convenient? Charges against several officers at My Lai were dropped. Callie remained the last man standing, as the one, if I may be so rude and crude, had the highest body count of unarmed men, women, and children, and was directly responsible not only in urging his men to commit these war crimes, but to commit them themselves, including a variety of rapes that took place that very day. And, of course, rape of the indigenous population. There are all kinds of anecdotal and settled stories from the U.S. Vietnam War, in which I would say that was unfortunately rather commonplace. March 29th, 1971, that very same day that charges against several of those officers are dropped, Callie's convicted. He's sentenced to life. President Nixon promises to personally review Callie's case. And then the trial against Medina commences. This ends without a conviction. And I have to take a brief pause here. One thing you have to understand is that when it comes, because of a Supreme Court decision from the Korean War, when it comes to trying soldiers for war crimes, you must catch them before they leave active service. Because if they've left active service, they cannot be returned to stand trial, nor can they stand a civil or criminal trial outside of the UCMJ milieu, the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So this is if I recall correctly, Jones talked about it was the very day before Lieutenant Calley was due to leave the Army, they charged him. Now, Calley was sentenced to life, but eventually that was reduced to 20 years. Medina, by the way, was acquitted of all charges after the jury deliberated for 60 minutes. And when I look at all the data and information that Jones provides in here, I have to wonder, why would they do that? January 27th, 1973, a little under 2 years afterwards, a ceasefire agreement is signed. March 29th, 1973, as I had mentioned earlier, last U.S. ground troops leave Vietnam. Congress votes to end all the bombing in Indochina in July. Now, moving on to Calley. December 21st, 73, and remember this is 6 months after the last U.S. ground troops leave Vietnam, the Military Court of Appeals upholds Calley's conviction, but his sentence is reduced to 10 years. Then his conviction is reviewed by a district court. Then Calley, in 74, November 74, is released on bond. November 13, 1974, I mentioned that Pierce report that had been released into the Army under classification was released in part 4 years later. Now, April 30th, 1975, those familiar with the history, Saigon falls. We all know about that helicopter leaving the embassy roof. That's April 75. September 75, a mere 5 months afterwards, Calley is paroled, and he's only served 3.5 years of what was a life sentence that was reduced to 20, that was reduced to 10. In 1998, Hugh Thompson was honored in a 30th anniversary commemoration for his heroism at My Lai by both Vietnamese and Americans, because if it weren't for Hugh Thompson, and if it weren't for several journalists like Ron Ridenour, none of this would have occurred. None of them would have been held accountable. And this would have just been swept under the rug. What's really disturbing about this entire thing is that I suspect that this was the tip of the iceberg. I suspect that these kind of atrocities and war crimes, and not simply sexual assault, but the kind of maiming and murder that took place on that dark day in March 1968, it's been the way of American war for the longest time. I mentioned earlier about what happened in the Philippines. Take a look for yourself. Look at all the first-hand accounts and the secondary source documentation that talks about what happened, for instance, on the island of Davao between 1898 and 1902, where all males over the age of 10 were eminently targetable by military arms if they were found loose in the wild. That's awful. As a matter of fact, it is the Philippines where waterboarding originated. Of course, in the Philippines, now it depends on the reports that you look, and remember, this is the turn of the 20th century, one-third to two-thirds of all people waterboarded died during the process. Now, I want to review a few things here. In the Army's investigation, 13 men were charged with committing these crimes. One, Lieutenant William Calley, is convicted of war crimes, and he's sentenced to life in prison. You saw what happened to that life in prison, where we find that he's released on bond by November 9th, 1974. The investigation also finds that the AmeriCal Division's chain of command had suppressed reports on the incident. So I'm not speculating on that. Howard Jones isn't speculating on that. It's all there in the documentation, that active suppression of the reportage of war crimes by the U.S. Army at the time was actively denied by the chain of command until they got caught out. I'm sad to report that the heroes of My Lai, in my estimation, Hugh Thompson and Larry Coburn, are both dead, both dying of cancer. Before they passed away, however, the Army did recognize their heroism, and these were helicopter pilots and crewmen. With the award of the Soldier's Medal, the Army's highest military decoration for non-combat valor, Ron Ridenour, the journalist who blew the lid off this whole thing, his letters actually triggered the investigation. He's dead now. Major General Coster, the general officer commanding of the AmeriCal Division, which was the divisional element under which Cali and Medina fought. He was never court-martialed. Charges against him were dismissed after a pretrial investigation. However, small deserts. Secretary of the Army Stanley R. Resser revoked Coster's Distinguished Service Medal and vacated his temporary rank of Major General, reducing him to his permanent rank of Brigadier General. Coster then went on to retire in 73, and he died in 2006 at the tender age of 86, unlike a lot of those folks who died on the ground, in the ditches, in the wells, and in the jungle of My Lai on that dark day in March 1968. If you're interested in getting a really good sense of the lies that were told to you about American history, and the lies you learned about military history, and all of the deception, confabulation, magic thinking, and exhaustively stupid reasoning that has gone into most of the history we were fed in government schools, this is a great corrective. This book, by itself, with nearly 90 pages of footnotes, and one can follow those footnotes, and I'm pretty assiduous about that, and I did fact-check some of this, because you will find that when it comes to academia today, one of my bugbears is not only the reproducibility crisis in which, in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, a lot of what is reported in the academic journal industry can't be done by anybody else because it's fake shit. But the other problem, of course, as we know from the fall of Miss Gay at Harvard University, is the amount of plagiarism that's going on. Now, plagiarism has a twofold manifestation. Number one, you're stealing other people's work. But number two, and this begs the question, and maybe this is something that should be examined also, is that why are people plagiarizing? Well, they're plagiarizing because they're lazy and they're not critical thinkers. I mean, mind you, Miss Gay at Harvard University, she plagiarized acknowledgments. Acknowledgments. It's just awful. So academically, I would have never expected anything, and I don't think that this came out of an academic press, even though it was published by Oxford. Howard Jones, he's done his homework, like I mentioned the footnotes, and he is not sparse, but he is very measured in economic and very clear in alleging what he does, and he provides the footnotes and receipts to show that he can corroborate what he's saying. In a previous episode, I had quoted from Jones, and I want to quote a little more from his brilliant book. Quote, "My My Lai was a turning point for so many reasons, not least for the ways in which it tarnished the image many Americans have had of their soldiers, and that the soldiers had of themselves. Veterans came home expecting to receive a warm welcome, but instead encountered widespread and vicious criticism of their actions in Vietnam. More than a few veterans felt that Cali had cast a dark shadow over the military. Perhaps the most outspoken critic was Harry G. Summers, a retired colonel in the U.S. Army, veteran of the Korean and Vietnam Wars, and best-selling author of the books on military strategy. At a 94 conference on My Lai at Tulane University, he told the audience, Cali and Medina ought to have been hung and then drawn and quartered, and the remains put at the gates of Fort Benning to remind all who enter of the consequences. The bastard fell through the cracks. In a television interview, David Hackworth agreed with that position. The colonel said Cali should have been lined up against the wall and shot. The guy's a murderer." End of quote. Now, this will probably resonate with some of you because I did quote that very same thing in a previous episode, but I find it very compelling. And I want to read this passage. "After My Lai, the Army felt compelled to implement reforms aimed at building a more professional military service. It produced, mind you, this is 73, 75. It produced television ads exalting work training and educational programs that better prepared soldiers for their post-Army life. It improved the screening of incoming soldiers in an effort to develop an army of character. rather than one of cast-offs or misfits. It raised the training level of both officers and enlisted personnel by emphasizing moral and ethical behavior in all situations, and it demanded strict enforcement of rules and regulations, embodying what William Hays Parks called the principle of restraint embodied in the laws of war. Those laws of war were nearly 100 years old by that time. To its credit, the Army immediately addressed the problems Milei had exposed. It revised and expanded policy directives regarding several key issues: the reporting of war crimes, the proper treatment of civilians, noncombatants, and prisoners of war, the protection of property, the adherence to the rules of engagement, and the enforcement of the Geneva and Hague Conventions as integral parts of the law of war. It also improved the management and maintenance of file records, because a lot of the files went missing in Milei, even when they were in safes. It also improved the management and maintenance of file records, ensured that all photos taken by the Army's photographers became its property, which, if in effect in 68, would have kept Hayborough's photos from becoming public in 1969, called for clarification of colors and using smoke canisters to mark locations, and placed first sergeants in the field to be closer to the men and raise morale. End of quote. What they're talking about with the colors of smoke is that if red color smoke were used, which was used at Milei that day, despite the fact that there were no combatants or VC or North Vietnamese regulars present, meant that it signified it was a free fire zone in which you could shoot at anything that moved and killed anything that moved. Now, let's fast forward. So, I had mentioned a little earlier that General Ronald Griffith warned his brigade commanders, 1st Armored Division commander, in the 1st Gulf War, "No Mileys in this division. Do you hear me?" End of quote. And then they go on, quote, "2 years later in 1993, the Army incorporated almost verbatim the 9 Marine Corps principles into the soldiers' rules by the Army. These principles held, among other things, that soldiers are not to engage noncombatants or harm those who surrender or become prisoners. They must care for all wounded, and they cannot interfere with medical workers or damage their equipment, nor can they steal or needlessly destroy property. They must treat civilians in a humanitarian way, and they must report violations." And then goes on to say, by June 2015, after nearly 2 decades of work, the DOD, Department of Defense, completed the updating and expansion of the U.S. Army's Field Manual 27-10 and released it as the DOD Law of War Manual. More than 1,200 pages in length, the volume covers a multitude of issues, including attempts to correct the flaws that helped lead to the events of March 16, 1968, end of quote, of course, that being Milei. Now, by the way, quote, "The echoes of Milei and Abu Ghraib are unmistakable. All members of the armed services must refuse to comply with clearly illegal orders that violate the law of war, particularly those orders to kill defenseless people who are under effective physical control," end of quote. So I have, if this were a five-star review of the book, I can think of very little with this book I find is satisfying. It's a tight, controlled narrative that's well documented from primary and secondary source documentation, well-reasoned, almost reads as a crime novel that's not a novel, but nonfiction, and it's extraordinarily well done. So if you get the opportunity, please read this book or listen to the Audible narration, which is just as good. Okay, and I've got to do a shout-out to Daryl Cooper here, and I'm guilty of not listening to his podcast, and I was just alerted that he had done a podcast on this. Daryl Cooper of Martyr Made, one of my favorite history podcasts of all time. The guy's just, he is so on point when it comes to sussing out all the details and the matrices and the tapestry and going back in time and figuring out, like we all do with great historians, it isn't about dates, it's about what's rhyming, what happened, what were the effects that were caused, and how did this ripple out from the past? How does it ripple into the future? All of that. Daryl Cooper, along with Daniel Bolelli, who is an Italian podcaster who I really enjoy too, another great historian. They did I think it was Anything That Moves, the Milei Massacre with History on Fire. And I think it was number 10 for Bolelli's podcast. I'll be sure to put this in the show notes. It's part 2 of a series. that they'd been working on. And in part one, they covered the 1864 Sand Creek Massacre that was carried out by the U.S. Army. Mind you, as I told you at the beginning of this podcast, none of this is new. I'm certain if you were to peruse the 90 pages of footnotes that Howard Jones has in his book, you can also go down the rabbit hole and find plenty of other data to consume on the My Lai Massacre and also the 32 volumes of the Piers Inquiry is available to you online. I've also put that in the show notes in case anybody wants to take a year off and read all of that stuff. That kind of thing is not the kind of brain damage that I want, so I won't be reading all 32 volumes. But I am appreciative that they managed to unearth that and make that unclassified and available to everybody. And I also have an ongoing suspicion that once somebody starts digging at this, like we had investigative journalists back then, like Ridenour and Hirsch, who would go after this like a dog on a bone, and they would uncover stuff, and they managed to embarrass an entire administration and an entire army apparatus deployed on foreign soil and doing ugly things, bad things, dark things. I've mentioned before, none of this is new in American arms. By the way, I'm not picking on American arms. None of this is new in any arms. I remember when I worked on the Appleseed Project, and we would talk about the three strikes of the match, and we would talk about what animated and really set the kindling into a broad fire for the secession from London on April 19th and 20th, 1775. And one of the things that occurred there on a little bridge just outside of Boston was apparently somebody who may have been either mentally ill or mentally limited had carved up a British redcoat corpse on the bridge. Carved it up. I won't go into the details here. You can read about it if you looked into it. Because of that, it set everybody's shoulder to the wheel among the colonials that, and in the British ranks, that if this kind of thing was going to happen, then no mercy would be offered. Then no quarter would be offered. Much as Stonewall Jackson talked about just before the assault in Gettysburg, where he said that no quarter can be given to those who have invaded our homes and such, I paraphrase. That no quarter tends to happen as a result of these kind of predations, rapine culture, and just death dealing on unarmed civilians. It doesn't end well. It never does. For anything any army is involved in. There's a lot of triumphalist narratives in American history, especially American military history, where the Americans could do no wrong. There's, as I mentioned earlier with the cottage industry, there's a cottage industry out there of historians who say that the Allied treatment of not Russian-occupied Europe, especially against the Germans, was absolutely horrific, to include the deprivation, the rapine culture, and the injuries and deaths and starvation that occurred as a result of the Allied occupation. We've all heard the stories and confirmed the stories of how awful the Russians were to both German soldiers and civilians. We know of this. But I guarantee you, for the most part, if you look at any conflict in history, you will find these stories. And since we're speaking to moral injury, and I think that if you're a soldier, unless you happen to have been one of the most fortunate soldiers in the history of mankind and the history of finding yourself in a combat theater, who had an absolutely seamless, impeccable, and unmarred good war tapestry to everything that you did, God's go with you. But not all of us had that. When it comes to moral injury and these kind of things that happen, this is something we have to live with the rest of our lives. And it's something that we can share, of course, with generations going on back possibly to the beginning of warrior mankind, where these kind of things are observed. I remember my children asking me when I was still in uniform, "Dad, what do you do for a living?" And, you know, I go to war, and What does that involve? It involves killing people and break things, as Rush Limbaugh would tell us in the 1990s and the early part of the 21st century before his death. And of course it does involve that. But it also involves laws of land warfare, the Hague Convention, the Geneva Convention, which places limitations, left and right limits, on one's behavior. Because if you don't make that distinction, then that means that every army is merely a composite parade of serial killers. Well, that's why we have the laws of land warfare. That's why we treat civilians. That's why we treat surrendered threats the way we do. That's why one renders aid, first aid, medical aid, when one can. That's why when a child is injured, for those who have children or don't have children, we are wired for empathy when it comes to injured children or injured women, as far as that goes. And we will come to their aid, and we will. I've seen several of those pictures from the Afghan war and the Iraqi war with Americans holding children who have been injured in some horrific fashion. I think that we're seeing some of that with the current Israeli Gaza miasma that's going on. This is part of one's humanity. And if your humanity is something that you will sell on the auction block so that you can be a killer in a war zone, then you are no different than a serial killer. I am not singing the praise of conflict. I am not saying that men's hasanas and histories and songs about war are all unmarred and glorious, because those of you in my audience who have been there know that there are inglorious moments in warfare, no matter how glorious it may be while you're sipping it in your memory palace as a fine wine. That's not the case at all. Again, what I've discovered in all my reading, all my investigation, all the preparations that I make for this podcast, is that for the most part, it's hard for me to justify any war that takes place on anything but my own soil, because everything beyond that really has awful implications by extension and unintended consequences and second and third order effects that especially those who are in power, whether politicians, civilians, soldiers, Department of Defense civilians, State Department, you name it. And when I look around today, I find myself thinking, don't you have any extrapolative forecasting capability whatsoever to see that what you do now is going to borrow an awkward phrase for this twisted allegory, it will echo in eternity. It will ripple into everything that we do. Don't pray for war. Pray to be spared from it. So, those who wish to send me gentlemanly correspondence, that would be cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. If you find that you can leave reviews at the vendor that you listen to me on, to, whether it be Spotify or Amazon, or I think Audible's part of that, or Apple, or wherever you are, if you can leave the stars, whatever they may be, write a review, I'd really appreciate that. And also, just pay attention and take the time to think critically. As I said in the last two episodes, thinking critically is hard work. And this is all it is. Critical thinking is thinking about thinking to improve your thinking by better thinking. The Stoic masters taught me well. So if you seek to get in touch with me, I look forward to hearing from you. Again, thank you for your solicitude and listenership. This is Bill, out.